Welcome to Civica's Voices. I'm your host, Aarti Narsi. Over the last year, Russia's war against Ukraine has taken center stage. It's dominated international headlines, with civil society both in and outside the conflict area mobilizing to support people fleeing the war. The war has also triggered a debate on how Western nations responded to this war in comparison to conflicts in countries like Ethiopia, Iran, and Palestine. As the war drove mass migration, we also witnessed how excluded groups were often most impacted. We saw how non-European refugees coming from the Middle East and North Africa who fled the war faced discrimination and violence. Civil society is crucial in responding to the war, but this work is usually so much more difficult in war than in peacetime. Since this season of Civica's Voices looks particularly at the right to protest, we'll focus today on what it looks like in the middle of conflict and war. We speak to an organization tracking the right to peaceful assembly and expression in Russia, a human rights lawyer from Ukraine, and we'll hear the personal story of a human rights defender from Sudan. So, let's get into it. To talk about the situation in Russia, I'm speaking to Polina Kurakina from OVD Info. It's an independent human rights defense and media group, and they work both inside of Russia itself and globally to put an end to political persecution in Russia. Part of this work includes collecting really important data. For example, OVD Info has been documenting over 19,000 detentions for anti-war stances since the beginning of Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. The vast majority were in the first month, but these detentions are ongoing. Polina, thank you so much for joining us on Civica's Voices.
Thank you for having me.
So to start off with, how are the authorities cracking down on anti-war protesters and the critics of the government? And what would you say are the laws and legal justifications that the authorities are using to detain protesters?
It is a very complex question because there are a lot of laws that are being applied or misapplied to different protesters. There are several broad areas that I could explain to you. So the first one is an actual protest, so solitary picketing, people going out streets and so on. So here the legislation was already in place. It was already quite repressive. In Russia, you can't just go to protest without first getting a request from authorities. And if your request is very political, they just won't give it to you. So every protest is automatically unlawful. And a lot of persons would be just detained for simply going to protest, even though it's completely peaceful. So that is the first part. Then at some point, solitary picketing was allowed in Russia as the only type of protest that didn't necessitate some kind of request. But then now there are some rudiment anti-COVID legislation, which also can be creatively misapplied, and people would be detained even if there is only one person standing there. So that's how actual solitary picketing and protesting is being curtailed. Then there is a new legislation, which was applied to specifically targeting speech. And these laws, essentially, they prohibit everything. All kind of abstract sayings like no to war, yes to peace, or maybe there was even a case with blank piece of paper being held up, and authorities kind of understood what kind of sentiment and thought broad area. Also, this kind of repression started before the war, but intensified a lot. It is persecution of NGOs, foreign agent legislation, so on. Strict limitation of everything NGOs can do, and sometimes even liquidating these NGOs. So that's how they do it.
So you've just described how difficult the environment is for freedom of protest as well as freedom of expression. How would you say people are continuing to show resistance to this war in Ukraine?
I would say that the protest has modified quite a bit because from the beginning, the preferred method was protesting in the streets. But now people try to do it more subtly. So social networks are being used, a lot of anti-war sentiments are being expressed there. The problem is, of course, that now authorities really do try to battle this, but people still do comment. They still do express their views, they express their dissent, their disagreement with this war.
In other countries, we've seen that there's also a scale of anti-war protests. What sort of responses have been received to this? And would you say these protests have been impactful both inside and outside of Russia?
The problem is, of course, we don't have very reliable metrics in understanding how these protests were impactful, whether they changed somebody's mind, etc. I would say when people see that somebody else dissents, it really makes you think that there are like-minded people, which is incredibly important.
Now, you've described the risks associated with protesting, with speaking out against Russia's war on Ukraine. What would you say keeps you motivated and what gives you hope to continue fighting for this?
It's a little bit hard to fully describe it because sometimes it's just feeling that it needs to be done. You can't just sit there and hope that everything will resolve itself. So something that motivates me is that you have to try to better the situation. Otherwise, you would just feel that you failed the society and the country and that you contributed by not doing anything. And with the risks, human rights defenders face truly a lot of risks. And one of the problems with Russian legislation today and repressions today, it's very chaotic. You don't really know which law will be applied to you. Everything could be. So I am constantly under threat of being recognized personally as foreign agent, for instance, which is an incredibly restrictive status with certain criminal potential implications and administrative implications. Also, of course, I'm always under threat of being found discrediting Russian army administratively, criminally. And that's up to 5-7 years in prison.
What would you say is needed in terms of international solidarity to the work that you do, but also in relation to Russia's war against Ukraine?
I would say there are two main areas. The first one is, of course, media attention. It is a little bit weird, but since the law doesn't really work that well in Russia, sometimes one thing that can really help people is just attention, news being made about them, just the fact that authorities know that these persons are not forgotten, that we always just look after them and follow their fate, it can help immensely. And the second part, I would say, would be international institutions trying to increase maybe even the funding of international institutions so they can look into more cases and so on. So when we had European Court of Human Rights, it was actually partially working institution for us because the compensations that were awarded by ICHR were given in Russia automatically. Now we don't have this very important tool and we have to resort to UN mechanisms and they're often overworked. They don't have enough resources to kind of cope with the amount of cases we brought them. And I think that it would be an immense help if international community helped these international institutions to improve them, fund them, basically build the capacity of these institutions to cope with so many cases and so many violations. Frankly, those are two main areas. Maybe the third one would be also some kind of capacity building with Russian NGOs and to try to communicate with these NGOs, to share information, to share expertise.
Polina, thank you so much for joining us on Civica's Voices.
Thank you.
That was Polina Kurakina from OVD Info. And the case of Russia really illustrates the evolution of protests, from initially starting on the streets but facing repressions, to then moving on to social networks, which is another form of protest. But as in the case of Russia, this is even being met with censorship, and people are continuing to express their pushback, even though they are doing it anonymously. What Polina also pointed out is the importance of connecting with like-minded people, particularly in contexts that are heavily repressed and where people face propaganda as well as disinformation. And lastly, I think it's incredibly important that we reiterate the importance and the power of international media and institutional attention to keep this ongoing pressure on Russia to ensure that we continue to fight for the freedom of Ukrainian people. We now continue to look at this conflict from a different perspective. Oleksandra Matvichuk leads the Center for Civil Liberties in Kyiv and is a highly experienced Ukrainian human rights lawyer who has been a member of the Advisory Council under the Commissioner for Human Rights of the Ukrainian Parliament and on the UN Committee Against Torture. She made history through these nominations in various ways. Oleksandra has coordinated a number of international mobilization campaigns, including advocating for documentation of war crimes and against sexual violence. She's also been involved with the Revolution of Dignity in 2014, which is also known as the Ukrainian Revolution. Oleksandra, thank you so much for joining us on Civicus Voices. So, to start us off, please tell us about some of the mobilizations, protests, and other actions that Ukrainians have been able to undertake in the middle of the war.
Several times in Ukrainian history, we found ourselves in circumstances when the law doesn't work. And I know from my own experience, when you can't rely on law, you can still rely on people. And the first story which I can tell is the story of the Revolution of Dignity. It was a time when millions of Ukrainians stood up their voice against corrupt and authoritarian Yanukovych regime. And in order to stop this peaceful protest, the government started the large-scale and systematic persecutions against peaceful protesters. And I, with my team, created a civil initiative which is called Euromaidan SOS. We brought up several thousands of people to provide legal and other assistance to persecuted protesters. And every day, hundreds and hundreds of people who were beaten, arrested, tortured, accused in fabricated criminal or administrative charges passed through our care. And I remember very vividly that it was a time when we faced against the whole authoritarian state machine. The paramilitary groups cooperated with prosecutors. Prosecutors cooperated with courts. The former president, government, and majority of parliament, security service, etc., etc., were against peaceful protests. They want to liquidate it even physically. And in this situation, it was so easy to say, but what can I do? All my efforts are so modest, and stop fighting. But because our lawyers and our volunteers fought very honestly for each people, we start to work not only on legal, but on very important symbolical level. And each person who participated in Revolution of Dignity know that there is no guarantee. You can be beaten, you can be arrested, you can be even killed, but there are people who will fight for you. And this understanding provides protesters a courage to overcome the fear.
You've obviously just pointed out how protest has been powerful in terms of the Ukrainian mobilization. And we know that this war didn't happen overnight, even though it has been making more international headlines now than ever before. But what have you and the wider Ukrainian civil society experienced in terms of this developing threat?
When a Revolution of Dignity succeeded and authoritarian regime collapsed 9 years ago, Ukraine obtained a chance for the quick democratic transformation. Because during the Revolution of Dignity, people peacefully protested just for a chance to build a country where the rights of everybody are protected, a government is accountable, judiciary is independent, and police do not beat students who are peacefully demonstrating. And we paid a high price for it. More than 100 peaceful protesters were killed by police in the center of Kyiv. So when we obtained this chance to build such a country, in order to stop us on this way, Russia started this war of aggression. Russia started this war of aggression 9 years ago with occupation of Crimea and part of Luhansk and Donetsk region. And last year, Russia extended this war to the large-scale invasion. And war, it's different reality. It's very difficult to express how to live during the large-scale war. But the same things happened. When large-scale invasion started, international organizations evacuated their personnel, but ordinary people remained. And ordinary people started to do extraordinary things. It were ordinary people who took people out from the ruined cities. It were ordinary people who helped to survive under artillery's fires. It were ordinary people who broke encirclement to provide humanitarian aid. Ordinary people have a much greater impact than they even imagine.
Now, we know that protesting during war is incredibly difficult and almost impossible at times. So how would you say the protest and the mobilization movement has evolved given the war that's happening at the moment?
Now we have a huge wave of solidarity across the country, and state sector closely work with civil society and with business. Because this war has a genocidal character, Russia try to kill us physically or to force us to ruin our identity and to transfer Ukraine to Russian colony. And that is why Putin told that there is no Ukrainian nation, there is no Ukrainian language, there is no Ukrainian culture, that we are the same people as Russians. And that is why it's very visible that a lot of Ukrainians joined to Ukrainian armed forces to defend our country, our people, and our democratic choice. And now we have a powerful army, but it's very interesting army. It's army of people who yesterday had different peaceful professions, who yesterday were journalists or designers or IT specialists or workers or farmers. And now they were forced to make this choice to defend the country with the arms. Because if we stop fighting in this genocidal war which Russia started, they will be no more us.
And as someone who is fighting for human rights, what sort of challenges and pushbacks have you experienced?
When we fight for human rights and freedom, and when we succeed in some stage, like after Revolution of Dignity, it means that you want the new task for yourself. Because in order to protect human rights and freedoms, you have to build a sustainable democratic state institutions. And it can't be appeared immediately when Revolution of Dignity succeed. You have to contribute into development of state institution on daily basis. And this is our lessons learned, that Ukrainian people are very good in overcoming authoritarian regime. We have several times of different peaceful revolution, but we still have to proceed our home task and to create institutions which will protect human rights. And this is a very important task for each society in transit.
Now, there's a lot of global support for Ukraine. What do you think people should know, and what can people across the globe do to support the Ukrainian effort for freedom?
It's very important to understand that it's not just a war between two states. This is a war between two systems, authoritarianism and democracy. Once again, this war started not in February 2022. This war started in February 2014, when the authoritarian regime collapsed, and we obtained a chance for a democratic transformation of our country. And with this war, Putin attempts not just punish Ukrainians for our democratic choice, which he made 9 years ago. Putin attempts to convince the whole world that democracy, rule of law, and human rights are fake values, because they couldn't protect you during the war. And that is why it's so important to demonstrate justice and to prosecute Putin, the top political leadership, and high military command for this war which they started, for committing the crime of aggression. Because now we documented horrible, horrible Russian war crimes. And all these crimes, it's a result of their leadership decision to initiate, to plan, and to start this war. This war about values. This war has a very vivid value dimension. And we in this war fighting for freedom in all senses, for a freedom to be independent country, not Russian colony, for a freedom to have and to preserve our Ukrainian identity and not to be forced to re-educate Ukrainian children as the Russians, and for a freedom to have democratic choice, to build a democracy which respect human rights and protect the rights of each people here.
Thank you so much for joining us on Savika's Voices.
I would like to express my huge gratitude to all people in different countries for solidarity and support which we received during this very dramatic time for Ukrainian history. There are a lot of things which have no limitation in national borders. Freedom is such a thing, and human solidarity is such a thing. We are grateful. Thank you.
As we've heard from Oleksandra, the fight for Ukrainian people started many years ago, where their protest movement was incredibly strong. But in the context of this war, they're moving towards other forms of resistance, both within Ukraine and outside of Ukraine. And what we must remember, as Oleksandra said, is that this is a fight between authoritarianism versus democracy. It's not just about two countries, Russia and Ukraine, but it's about a global challenge that we are facing throughout the world. As Oleksandra said, this is a fight between authoritarianism and democracy. It's not just about Ukraine and Russia, but it's about rising authoritarianism throughout the world. We now turn to a conflict that has gone on and evolved for many years. Nasreen Al-Saim is a youth climate activist from Sudan who was the chair of the UN's Youth Advisory Group on Climate Change. While her country is heavily impacted by climate effects, it is also presently in an active conflict and she is a war survivor. Since 2012, she has participated in and organized dozens of protests, both around climate and political issues, such as the toppling of the Omar al-Bashir regime. This year, the country's military leadership has been in the midst of a vicious power struggle. The violent conflict forced more than 2.2 million people to migrate and led to a severe humanitarian crisis. While it is almost impossible to organize typical protests during a war, Nasreen's experience shows what it's like to be at the forefront of a country repeatedly in conflict. Please note that in this clip she talks both about protesting during that time and her life now. Here's a little of her story.
My name is Nasreen Al-Saim. I'm from Sudan. The demonstrations against Bashir was sometimes, or most of the times, really hard, really difficult. One day, I remember that was the first day when they actually used nerve tear gas against the protesters, because they used it against us in the university before many times. So I think it takes longer to affect me than the rest of the protesters. A lot of protesters were running, but they were not actually moving. They were just standing in their place and running in slow motion. So I had to drag most of them a bit far from the open area. When me and another person went to drag the last two people, they start using bullets. And so one of them died that day. His name is Saleh. And his blood was all over my skirt. I was wearing a skirt because a lady who's wearing a trouser and sneakers, then it means that she's going for demonstration. So we used to try to hide us by wearing skirts. And I remember everyone were coming running towards me because they saw the blood on my skirt. They thought I was the one got injured. And I kept screaming, "Leave my skirt, it's not me." And no one listened, actually. I think they thought I'm in shock. So for 10 minutes, I was screaming, "It's not me, it's not me. We need to find the one who's injured. It's not me, leave my skirt alone." And after that, they realized I really am not the one who got shot. And we found the body on the floor. I think this was one of the hardest times. The thing I was worried most about planning for the demonstrations and during the demonstrations is if I got killed. Family is very much not active. So it would be very hard for them, for me to be going to jail or something, because they're not used to it. Not like the families who are coming from a long history of political activists. And this is everything I could think about, whether there's a gun firing or attempt to capture me or to get arrested. I was like, you can do this. You have to survive for your family. Demonstrations can take many ways. It doesn't have to be actually people in the street. But there's many other kind of demonstrations that there is the humanitarian demonstration. There is electronic demonstration, which is normally by social media campaigns and social media campaigns and so on. Currently in Sudan, not only in this war, but all of the previous conflicts that happened in the country, the civil society was always there, supporting the humanitarian aid distribution, but also raising finance and fundraising for the humanitarian aid, collecting data and information for the people to facilitate distribution and work. Of course, they did a lot of international push towards peace and security against al-Bashir, against Hemeti, and against al-Burhan and his generals all the time in the UN, in all of the big meetings. But these people don't understand the idea of the peaceful movement. And that's why any kind of demonstration will only put people into danger. I mean, I know more than 500 were actually killed inside of their houses, either by airdrops or by bullets. And these are people inside of their houses. So imagine if someone decided to go outside, what would happen? And for me, the highest desire is to actually conserve lives so they can build the country after the war and the conflict, and not to lose more.
That was Nisreen Al-Saim from Sudan. Nisreen's story really highlights the fears that protesters face when they are on the front line. They put their bodies and lives at risk, not knowing what will happen, but they continue to fight for a revolution that is worthy. I also want to highlight how women in Sudan have particularly been targeted, not only in the context of war, but repeatedly during protests. Coup leaders have systematically used sexual and gender-based violence to crack down on the pro-democracy movement. And women human rights defenders in Sudan are paying a heavy price for fighting for this revolution. That's it for this episode. We have heard from many different contexts today, some where protests are ongoing in the context of war and conflict that have been met with repressions, and others where resistance is being built in different ways. In the case of Russia, protests are facing incredible repressions, while in Ukraine, human rights lawyers continue to push for freedom of the Ukrainian people, both from inside Ukraine as well as outside. That's it for this episode. We have heard from many different contexts today, some where protests are ongoing in the context of war or conflict and met with repressions, and others where resistance is being built in different ways. In Russia, protesters are facing incredible repressions, while in Ukraine, human rights lawyers continue to push for freedom of the Ukrainian people, both from within Ukraine as well as outside. On the other side of the globe, in Sudan, which I do think doesn't dominate global headlines enough, we see that women human rights defenders and young people and others continue to lead the pro-democracy movement. As a helpful resource in connection with Russia, we recommend going to look at OVD Info's content and data. They do a monthly wartime repressions report that's really helpful. You can also check out Redress, which collects data and information on all developments related to transitional justice in Sudan, and the Sudanese Women's Rights Action, which provides a gender lens to the conflict and civic space. You can find Civicus online and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Subscribe, listen, and rate the podcast on your favorite podcast app. Thank you to all our guests today. Civicus Voices is produced by Alna Schütz, Jermaine Kricher, and the Civicus team. My name is Aarti Narsi, and until next time, goodbye.